Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Pastor Jim.
We're going to head into our Sunday school lesson, and you should have a handout with today's date on it. And we're beginning, I thought we'd be ending the whole book of the Benedict Option, but we're beginning the last chapter, which is on technology. And I've decided that I need to break it into at least two pieces, so we're getting the opening piece of it today. And the title of it is Man and Machine. It's not really technology as an idol, but I think that that applies at least as at a minimum as a risk to us. And there's a famous line that's repeated actually twice in the Psalms that they who make them shall be like them, meaning we become like our idols. And one of the things our author is going to talk about here is the idea that we, in some respects, end up becoming more machine-like and less human to the degree that we might have technological, digital-type, informational machines as our idols. And so I think that there's good, fair warning there. And when we get to the point where we hear about the fact that oftentimes our younger people have very low attention spans and really can't think deeply and really can't concentrate, some young people, that is, in the aggregate, that can be a mark of this. And if you look at what's happening in churches, one of the things they're doing is, oh, modern people, you know, they can't listen to a sermon that's more than 12 minutes long. Or it's broken up into little 12-minute segments because their mind has to reboot or rest or something like that. So let's stand together and sing this great Psalm 135, and it is about idolatry. Charge to us to keep first things first, and that is the Lord our God, that we should have no other gods before him. Lord, thank you for being good to us, being near to us, and bless us, we pray, in the Sunday school hour. In Jesus' name, amen. You may be seated. Good singing. Good psalm singing. So, yes, we're going to talk about technology here, and I don't want to make technology sound like it's an absolute all-the-time evil. We're going to see at least one scripture where we know that the Bible does support the use of technology. But if it becomes an idol, there is that ever-present warning that we will become like our idols. Not only will we be sinning, but we'll become like them. And so we want to be careful what we look to. This is the last chapter in the book, The Benedict Option. It's Man and Machine. And Lord willing, we'll be closing this out. You might remember next Sunday morning, we will have Pastor Jason Biette here. He's going to be bringing an update on the work in Fairbanks. And he'll be preaching for us as well next Sunday. So please be ready and look forward for that. But here we go. So our author talks about the fact that he had an experience some 5 or so years ago. He's at the monastery, right? And the cell phone reception is out. I don't know if any of you have had this experience lately or not, but I remember when cell phones first went out, we were with the FORC still at that time, and they had their retreat. They called it a synod at the time, and we were in the mountains of Western Virginia. And they're just, I mean, you had to drive a long way to get any cell reception. So anyway, he's at the monastery here, and it was impossible for him to do that. And I had this experience when we had our internet service was down. And even now, with this steel roof that we have, if you drive by here, you could see me standing near the window talking on my phone, because that's where I get the reception. So you stand in a corner and you hope for the best, right? He was startled that how anxious it had made him to lose this connectivity, right? 20 years earlier, hey, it's another day at the beach, right? Nobody would have noticed. End of that paragraph, having a mobile connection has become so normal that we don't notice it until we don't have it. It's like, holy cow, what's going on here, right? And how many times a day do we reflexively reach into our pocket or purse, right, to pull out our iPhone and to check whatever it is we always check? We're turning the page. So this digital fast he had inadvertently imposed upon him, right, gave him this unplanned exercise in being a monk, being an ascetic. Was revealing, and he didn't like what he saw. He went to the conference while he was there, and the speakers were good, but you know what? He still found himself not able to give them full attention because he's got that little thing in there. Maybe it's even on vibrate, but it's still in there, or it's itching your leg, right? It becomes second nature in his addiction, right? The addiction was invisible to him. But everybody else was doing the same thing. And I have this little note here because I had some conversations with people about sermon length. And, you know, across our culture, there is this idea where, I mean, heaven forbid, you know, you preach for 40 minutes or more, because it just can't happen. Now, there can be some other good theological reasons for shorter sermons, meaning the center of a worship service is right there. It's that table. And the sermon should be facilitating our access to that. And I remember somebody talking one time, and they said, you know, what a church service shouldn't be, this is a family meal here, right? And the children are gathered around the table. And so imagine yourself in your own home setting. I'm getting off on a sidetrack here. So imagine yourself in your own table at home, and the kids are there, and mom has put forth this great, great meal. You're there for the meal, and you know you can't wait for it, and dad decides to give a speech, and he just goes on and on and on and on, right? And then he pulls out a flip chart, and he says, well, look at this point. And do you know that meat, if it's cooked at this temperature for this long, all these, you know, and goes on and on, and you don't want to do that, and all of a sudden the food's cold, right? And you've ruined the meal. So a sermon shouldn't ruin the meal.
Thank you. I've said that another Sunday.
I purposely did that today. By the way, if Michael ends up being short today, you'll know why, right? Okay? If he goes a little long, you say, I'm hungry. You say, let's have a collective like stomach growl or something if he goes on too long. But it was kind of a sidebar. So. All right, so there we go. All right, middle of the page. There's a simple matter of individuals not being able to manage their smartphone use. Of course, once you're in idolatry and addiction, you've lost, right? But it's even worse than that, okay? It compromises our ability to make sense of the world, and physiologically, it is actually rewiring your brain. This instant information is rewiring your brain. And you talk about people who don't have patience with people anymore? This doesn't help that, right? It rewires our brain. We think that our technology gives us more control, and in fact, there's a flip side, a darker side, that they end up controlling us. To use technology is to participate in a cultural liturgy. Interesting. Inescapable, right? The only meaning there is in the world is what we choose to assign in our endless quest to master nature. We saw in earlier chapters here this idea that science there is to help man to bring relief to his estate. We all get that. But what we on the next page now, we've turned this into a virtual reality here. The Benedict option, last paragraph there, and communities who remain apathetic towards technology inadvertently undermine nearly everything they are trying to achieve. Technology itself is a kind of liturgy that reaches us to frame our experience in the world in certain ways that, if we aren't careful, profoundly will distort our relationships to God, to other people, and to the material world, and even our self-understanding. Go out to lunch with someone, anybody, and you know what? Unless they've really mastered this, unless they've really come to grips with how rude it can be, they will be rude to you, or you will be rude to them. By checking your phone, looking at it. You know, it could be a big conversation. All of a sudden, you're there alone because they're somewhere else, right? Then he has this segment here where he says technology is not morally neutral. And I got a big there, because on some levels it is, on some levels it isn't. And so we're going to head into this part of it. I do want us to see at the very bottom of this page where he says that to technological man, truth is what works to extend his dominion over nature and to make that stuff into things that he finds useful or pleasurable. I mean, if it helps, use it, right? Therefore, fulfilling his sense of what it means to exist. And so, extending your dominion. Now, dominion is a good thing, right? And I don't want us to think that technology is always bad, it's evil, that it's to use technology as idolatrous, or that the Bible doesn't support technology, okay? And I have a Bible verse for you here. This is from Ecclesiastes. This chapter just made me think of this verse. Ecclesiastes 10:10. If the iron be blunt, this is kind of like the edge of an axe. If the iron be blunt and he do not whet the edge, whet the edge is an old word for like sharpening something. If the axe is blunt and he does not sharpen the edge, then must he put forth more strength. But wisdom is profitable to direct. So, here you are, you're out chopping wood, you got your axe. Hey, it's up to you. Do you want to have to really swing harder and do twice as much exertion yourself, or do you want to just sharpen the blade a little bit? Right? So, that's technology. Is it bad to sharpen your axe? I don't think so. Now, you can make your axe an idol, right? Hey, look at this thing, everybody, and I love it. And I sleep with my axe, and you know. So, sharpening the edge of your axe is not a bad thing. Increases your dominion, right? Makes life easier, okay? Instead of me, you know, just killing myself, you know, splitting a little bit of wood here and spending hours and hours and hours doing it and expending my body, if I just sharpen the axe, I get it done in one third of the time with way less stress on my body. Those are a good thing. Okay? And by the way, that Bible verse doesn't say you have to sharpen your axe. You don't have to. Anyway, the Bible's not anti-technology, but we have to be careful with it. And if we're not careful with it, they will be tools, as it says here, that have turned the tables on us. And they gain the ground to direct our metaphysical and our theological convictions, even. I mean, our convictions about what a church service should look like is going to be really different. Hey, I don't know if this already exists, but I remember people making fun of this not too many years ago, where you put the goggles on and you have virtual church, right? And you're laying in bed, right? And you have virtual church, you got your jammies on, but you're missing something there. The rubbing of shoulders with other real human beings, right? And the body of Christ and communion. So this technology can impact our theological convictions. Because somebody could say, hey, I put my goggles on and I went to virtual church today and I was at church today. That's because technological man understands freedom as liberating from anything that is not freely chosen. And these are important concepts here. And we've come to the point where we are near unto being technological man here, even us. We're impacted by it. And it means the freedom and the liberation from anything that is not freely chosen by the autonomous individual. Oh, you like to go to church and show up in person? Good for you. I like to put my virtual reality goggles on. And so he says this is why Americans are naively optimistic about technology. So, true confessions. Next paragraph down. In one sense, technology is truly neutral. Right? The same bulldozer that's used to build a hospital can be used to build a concentration camp. Fair enough, right? Fair enough. More deeply, though, technology as a worldview trains us to privilege what is new and innovative over what is old and familiar and to valorize the future uncritically. You know? How many of us have had the experience where a younger person comes by and says, you're still using that? What's wrong with you, caveman? Right? It destroys tradition because it refuses any limits on its creativity. Technological man says, if we can do it, then we must be free to do it. Yeah. Okay, so now we're getting closer to this knife edge where we can run into trouble. If we can do it, we must be free to do it. Meaning allowed to do it, meaning that it's morally okay to do it if we can do it. So he's going to go into a segment here, and I'm going to call this step one in how this could happen. And the bottom of this page here, where it begins in a provocative but insightful formulation, this is a part of our past, really. It's about birth control. It's about contraception, which is a relatively new phenomenon in the world. Okay, in terms of, there always were some things that people would try to do, but this whole idea where, you know, starting in the 60s, where it became very, very, very easy for people to engage in sexual activity with absolutely no fear of pregnancy would be step one. Step two starts on the next page, and this gets a little bit dicier. And this is in vitro fertilization. Now, we're not castigating any of this as completely evil, but there are some things that we need to think through as we go through that sort of thing. Just like we need to think through some things when we talk about birth control. So he talks about the history of IVF, he's calling it here, in vitro fertilization. And the whole idea of how Americans have seen it. Is it morally right? Is it morally wrong? Halfway down the page, he says this. As to the commodification of childbearing, consider the childless Tennessee couple who had donor eggs fertilized with her husband's sperm, creating 10 embryos. Four babies later, the couple decided they didn't want the remaining embryos and took to Facebook to offer them to a good home. Now, that's a pretty crass thing to do. And this is how the ad went. We have six good quality frozen 6-day-old embryos to donate to an amazing family who wants a large family, the wife posted. We prefer someone who has been married for several years with a steady, loving relationship and strong Christian background who does not already have kids but wants a boatload. Now, I mean, can you imagine seeing that on Facebook? But hey, anything's possible on Facebook, right? But according to Orthodox Christian teaching, these are six human persons, right? If we believe that life begins at conception, then life begins at conception. The embryo donation community has developed a cute euphemism, right? That's a good way of saying something that might not be so good for these unborn children. We call them frozen snowflakes. Who could be against frozen snowflakes? Right? And so now he goes into some stats about this. And he talks about the fact that, you know, what happens with these embryos that aren't used. 93% never resulted in pregnancy. About half were thrown away without even trying. He says the United States doesn't have reliable records about this, but if we upgrade the population level to equal that of America, that means there would be 17.5 million unborn human beings brought into existence in a laboratory, with 16.2 million of them dying, and 8 million of them thrown into the trash without even an attempt at implantation. So let's continue on here to see the point that we want to make here. And so he ends up building some comparison in the next paragraph. Next paragraph down says, clearly there are millions of Americans who are of Christians who are not really putting two and two together. Many conservative Christians strongly oppose abortion and the laws that want to restrict it. But there's no movement to ban or restrict IVF. Even though from a life begins at conception point of view, it exterminates millions of unborn lives. What enables this hypocrisy? It's our technology mentality. So here we go. This is the price of admission for today. Next paragraph. The argument goes like this. Babies are good things. All right? I mean, if I were to ask that question, right, all the hands go up, right? Babies are good things. So anything that technology does to help people have babies is therefore good. Don't get sidetracked by the love wins, right? The technocrat decides what he or she wants, and once it is available by way of technology, rationalizes accepting it. Concealing what technology takes away from us is a feature of the technocratic worldview. We come to think of technological advances as inevitably because they are irresistible. Just as truth is for the technocrat what is good and useful, what is good for him is what is possible and desirable. Okay, I'm going to stop right there. If you look at the modern American mindset, what is good is what is available and what is possible for me to get. And we often don't think about any other consequences to that. Any other criteria other than that. Okay? What is good for him is what's possible and what's desirable. And again, babies, who can vote against babies, right? Technological man regards as progress anything that expands his choices and gives him more power over nature. Oh, I can get it now. I couldn't before, but now I can. I want us to be careful with this step two here, okay? Because not all IVF babies, right, are managed in the crass, poor way that these are managed, okay? There can be safeguards that don't do this. So I want to be really careful there and sensitive about that. Technological man regards progress as anything that expands his choices, gives him more power over nature. Americans admire the self-made man because he has liberated himself from dependence on others by his own efforts and his own creation. I mean, the guy who invented sharpening an axe, I mean, he was guilty of the same thing on a smaller scale. But here we go, and this is a challenge. For technological man, choice matters more than what is chosen. Now, if that doesn't have Americana written all over it, choice matters more than what is chosen. Think about an issue we know well, like abortion. Choice matters more than what you're choosing to do. Choice has become the god. Choice has become the idol. Technology has made that available. He is not much concerned with what he should desire. Rather, he is preoccupied by how he can acquire or accomplish what he desires. Okay? I desire something that must be good, and therefore it doesn't matter how I get it. The seed that was planted in the 14th century of the triumph of nominalism reaches its full ripeness here in technological man. Now, I've included here, for your listening pleasure, a hypothetical step three, which isn't a part of this article. And this was prompted by an actual story that I saw in the news some weeks ago, where it says they are really well on their way to cloning your pet. Because you like your pet, right? Who hasn't been through the heartache of your pet dying? But you'll never have that heartbreak if you clone your pet. Now, that's not step three. Step three for us is, what about you have a child? All right? And it doesn't matter whether this is possible right now to take a child who's already 5 years old and clone them. I think that technology probably exists. It certainly existed for sheep, right? So here's your child, and he's 5 years old, and so just out of a safeguard, you would take whatever you do that you take out of a human being to begin a cloning process or to put it in storage to clone it later, and that child doesn't die of some horrific disease or cancer or anything, but that child ends up getting in a car accident, right? Something completely outside of his biophysical makeup. So he doesn't have a defect. You don't have to worry about that. But you love that child with all your heart. And so I don't think there's anything that would stop us from cloning. You know, he's just the greatest kid ever. I mean, how could you not love him? And maybe you already got hit by a car, and before they finally, you know, pull the plug, they harvest something from him. You didn't even intend to do that, but now he's gonna die, and so you take some cells out of him and you clone him. Is that a good idea? Just because it can be done, should it be done? For me, that would be a step three. And I'm not going to answer that question. I'll let you guys answer that question, whether you think that looks like something that could happen in the future. Can't imagine why it wouldn't. Cloning a healthy child. But the point I'm trying to make is just because everything can be done doesn't necessarily mean it should be done. And that which we think is good doesn't always equate to what is morally sound. I'm sure you guys could think of other examples. We're going to turn the page here. The internet as a floodgate of modern liquid modernity. He said that so many times, I just think I should make a drink out of that. What do you think? I should just sell it. He says liquid modernity. Meaning, and again, anybody here know what he means by that? I've been over this 1,000 times. What does he mean by liquid modernity? Nobody knows what he means?
Changing.
Yeah, everything changes before it has a chance to solidify, right? So nothing in the culture really has any gravitas, right? That no real weight. It's just fluid. You hear a lot about fluid today, right? Okay, so back to technology here. We're off step one, step two, and step three in terms of reproduction. We're back to raw technology. The most radical, disruptive, and transformational technology ever created is the internet, okay? Again, we're not trying to make an evil out of that. But the last sentence here, the internet rapidly accelerates the political, social, and cultural fragmentation process that has been underway since the mid-20th century and profoundly compromises our ability to pay attention. And the research is abundant. People don't have the ability to pay attention the way they used to. So can young people listen to a sermon? Should the church accommodate that? This is a bigger deal than it sounds. The medium is the message. We heard about that earlier on. Why is this important? Because the medium alters the way we experience the world and interpret it. Yeah, some additional concerns here. To go through the screen of your computer or smartphone is to enter a world where you don't have to deal with anything not chosen. I don't like that. You talk about why we're in an echo chamber. You talk about why, I mean, your news feed, okay, is the product of a bunch of logarithms, whereas if you're kind of like, you know, a blue state leaning kind of person, you're going to be filled with all these things, right, that are going to support your worldview, and they're going to demonize anybody who's from a red state perspective. And if you're a red state perspective kind of person, you're going to get stuff that's going to reaffirm. So no wonder we have these echo chambers and we have this widening. You don't have to deal with anything you don't want to. You can be invisible on the internet. That's another problem. You can create your own identity. That's another problem. There is no linear logic at work in your internet. You can skitter from site to site, dipping in, out of social media, as you desire. I work as an online journalist and spend most weekends doing exactly that. And, I can remember when the internet, or when computers first came out. I mean, it was just like, it was such a mixed blessing for men. They could finally be Captain Kirk, right? They're sitting on the bridge, they're in their chair, they hit a button, and things happen. Now, real life doesn't happen that way. I have kids, I have a wife, I want something to be done. It doesn't happen just like that, especially with my kids, right? Sometimes I get helpful back talk from my wife. Don't do that. I never ever heard anybody say that to Captain Kirk, at least not a lady, right? Maybe Scotty would say that or Spock would say that. But see, when a computer first came out, it was instant obedience, unswerving obedience. The man was in absolute command. That's not real life, folks. As you desire. And guess what? It's wonderful. It made my life better in more ways than I can count, right? Making it possible for me to live where I want to live because I can work from home, right? The internet has given me a great deal, and it does so every day. And all God's people said, yeah, right? But the internet, like all new technology, also takes away. But they don't advertise that. They don't tell us that. Okay? Takes away from us our sense of agency. This whole idea that we're a part of a group here. We're going to turn the page and close this out here. More important things, though, because things are changing on the neurological level in our brains. And that's why when that computer first came out, these men, while they felt great about what was going on, they were completely frustrated with their wives and with their kids because they weren't responding the way this machine was responding to them. This machine was responding as if he was king, and he kind of liked feeling that way. So the internet experience gives us all these repetitive jolts, right? One thing is very clear. If knowing what we know today about the brain's plasticity, we were to set out to invent a medium that would rewire our mental circuits as quickly and thoroughly as possible, you would probably end up with designing the internet. The result of this is a gradual inability to pay attention, to focus, to think deeply. Study after study has confirmed the common experience. Many have reported that using the web makes it infinitely easier, listen to this, to find information, but much harder to devote the kind of sustained focus it takes to know things. Josh Cho lived at my house for about 8 years. He came here every day. Okay? During his last year here, I said, Josh, I'm driving. Take me to Oakwood. He had no idea how to get to Oakwood. Every place he has gone in his life was GPS generated. He never paid attention to any roads, maps, directions, anything. And Josh is his own special breed of person. I get that. But you get what I'm saying here. There's no need to know anything. You don't need to memorize anybody else's phone number. You probably need to know their name when you scroll down. Ah, there's Alan. You know, I hit the button. But in the old days, we all knew what Alan's phone number was. Right? Today, there's no need to know anything, to think deeply, to memorize it. This has implications for us. Easy to find information, how to get to Oakwood, plug in the address. Okay, follow whatever the lady's name is, says. Compounding the problem, the technological mentality denies that there is anything important to be known. That's a real problem in our culture, right? You have no values at all. Nothing important to be known. And so he tells us that this goes back to this juxtaposition here of techne, meaning craftsmanship, versus episteme, which is knowledge gained through contemplation. Techne refers to knowledge that helps you to do things, it's facts, right? While episteme refers to knowledge of how things are so that you will know what to do. Both of them are important. Both contemplation and action are necessary for human flourishing. The Middle Ages prized contemplation. Good for them, right? Everything was ordered by God. And the icon, so to speak, meaning the pictures, right? That's what icons are pictures, were a symbol of that age, right? You would see a picture. You would see that picture over there, and you would contemplate it. Ah, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning, the end. Contemplation is alien to the modern mode of life. The iPhone, with this luminous portal promising to show us the world, but really a mirror of the world inside our heads. I mean, we prompt the cell phone, right? We tell it what we want. We tell it what we want to hear. We tell it what we want to see. Is the icon of our age. That's a thoughtful coupling of ideas there. Under the rule of technology, conditions that make authentic Christian life possible begin to disappear. And he says, most of us have no idea it's even happening. Any thoughts about some of this? Was I too negative on technology? Too positive? Oh, George, all of us dinosaurs are saying, no, you were not too negative. Too negative on the young people? Maybe a little, right? Sure.
I guess I don't understand what he's actually going for here. Because he doesn't say that we shouldn't have technology. He doesn't say we shouldn't become Amish. He himself said that he works online on the internet every day. So, what does he want?
Yeah.
He says that, yeah, there's some problems, but okay. Now what?
Some of that will come, in all fairness, some of that will come at the end of the chapter where he will apply some of that. And so he will say things like, the church shouldn't give itself over to social media. And so, what's our liturgy going to look like here? I mean, a candle is a nice piece of technology, right? We have light that, we've had light for a long time. Even cavemen had that, I guess. But technology is inescapable. But he would say, he would not be for the strobe light type worship service.
No, but he lauds the medieval church, and the medieval church didn't have this. They didn't have writing. They didn't have paper. They didn't have
I get it.
The very things that he's doing.
Correct. And he wrote the book and sold the book. He could have just given us an icon. Chuck, that's a good point. Yeah.
My impression is trying to give us the idea that technology is unstable, that too much of it can
I'm not so sure he would even object to saluting to the two-edged sword, meaning it can come back to bite me. He would object to us saluting to the one edge and just see the positives of it. He wants us to see that maybe that's all he's trying to do, is to have us see that there's a down. For everything it gives us, let's look out and be careful because it may be taking some things away. And we have probably just, being the pragmatists that we are, we're going to choose the positives and ignore the negatives and think the negatives aren't really that negative. That may be his defense. Anybody else? Yes.
A story from Josh made me laugh. We've moved, down the road, a mile down the road.
Yeah.
And people I've known for years, or repairmen or something, you try and give them a location, and something we've gone by, I said, you know where the sheep farm is? Right there? Most of the people say, oh, I don't think I've ever seen a sheep farm. And you can't miss it. It's there.
Yeah.
There's sheep everywhere. You take a right past the sheep farm. And then the next statement is, just give me your address. I'll put it in my GPS.
Yeah.
It's, I, for one, see everything when I drive. And some people don't. And just the way. Well, no, I'm just saying, some are not engaged. But it just cracked me up. The first thing people say is, give me your exact address. I'll put it on my GPS.
Because they don't want to know.
Yeah, they don't want to know.
They want to be able to look it up when they need it on the way.
I used to move cars for Carmody. And they say, well, take one of the GPSs on the wall. And no. Open the map, drive to the place, look around, and say, if I was a car dealership, I'd be down this road. Or you stop at Stewart's and say, I'm looking for so-and-so forth, and they'll tell you. But it's amazing how people don't engage at all anymore.
When Josh did come here in the fall, I had helped him, and he had an Uber bring him here. And he had some stuff here, and I was to bring him back to his dorm.
How did he get to the dorm?
How did he get to the campus?
Oh, yeah.
That's modern life. He didn't need to know, or at least he didn't think he needed to know. And technology is allowing him to live without having to know.
Right.
Yes.
100 years from now, thought, just a thought, 100 years from now, the biotechnicians are going to go to Mount Vernon. They're going to open up George Washington's coffin, extract some DNA, clone George Washington, let him grow up, and elect him president. Just a thought question, or observation.
As long as George and I don't.
Oh, he's the real George and I don't.
No, he's not like, you know.
Georgette.
Sleepy John. Georgette.
I'm going to close in prayer because we're way past time. But so, look, you know, I don't want anybody timing Mike today. So.
Okay.
Leave your cell phone wherever you keep time. Take your watch off. Leave it in the fellowship hall or something. And listen to what God has for us. Father God in heaven, thank you for your grace today. And help us to be alert and attuned to these matters. And help us to know that indeed these technologies, Lord, they give us much. And help us at least to have an awareness of what they take away. Help us, Lord. Thank you for today. Help us as we respond to your call to bow before you as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords.